Good morning. We have broken the second week in February here in Chicago, which means that I can finally and rightfully say that I've experienced the coldest weather that the city has to offer. Thank goodness for that. Really quickly, as a personal anecdote, I rode the train for 4 hours each way a few weekends ago to see one of David Sedaris's book readings and subsequently died. As you probably know by now, Sedaris is one of my all-time favorite contemporary authors. I've read most of his books, and his sense of humor just really appeals to me, despite our having opposite views on many societal issues. But I met with him briefly for a book signing afterwards and was struck by how genuine the experience was, even though throughout the event he probably ended up meeting over 100 people. My only regret is that I had nothing of substance to say to one of his famous book signing questions, which was for me, "What do you think about Judge Judy?" And despite my lack of repertoire on her, I still have no opinion, so I'm sorry, Mr. Sedaris, if you're listening. I'm trying to get the person who went with me to do an episode on the event and on Sedaris' work in general, so look out for that. I don't know how many of you remember that I actually announced Wuthering Heights as our next episode, this episode, on a few different outlets, including Twitter, as well as the last episode. But the more I thought about writing about Wuthering Heights, the less equipped I felt, and if we're going to get through all of Joan Didion's books this year, we needed to do an episode or two on her in any case. Wuthering Heights is coming. I apologize for those of you who may be disappointed by the lack of Heathcliff in this episode. So, to make it up to y'all, I'm finding a special guest, hopefully a professor or scholar, that can talk with me legitimately and at length about the novel with me. If you have any suggestions, I've linked a post in my blog where you can comment on the names and contact information for people who you might think would fit this role. South and West is Joan Didion's most recent novel, published in March of 2017. It is the first novel that she has written since she became known for writing about grief and trauma, though it is one that consists of unearthed writings from the 1970s, with rare edits from the author in our contemporary time period. The novel also has a brilliant selection of old excerpts embedded within it from the 1800s, most of them describing areas of the South. And as it indicates, the novel centers on the South but has additions on California at the very end. Something I really liked from the Vintage International edition that I have is its foreword written by Nathaniel Rich. It's rare for foreword writers, especially from the forewords of the classics that I'm used to reading, to get out of a strictly academic voice and into something more unique, but Nathaniel Rich does something really interesting in that he seems to mimic the no-nonsense, highly communicative, dry prose style of the author herself, which actually serves to bring out the quotes that he mentions in the beginning even more so than an author with a completely different prose style would have. There's something called walking back the cat in academia, and the first time I heard it used was in Malcolm Gladwell's foreword in The Person and the Situation by Rawson Nisbett. Yes, it's a literal psychology textbook that I'm currently reading if you're curious. The term means to look at the references in the academic article that you've just read and then go back and read their references and then read the references, references, and so on and so forth. It's something that I've been doing a ton lately, especially in regards to the linguistics courses I'm taking, because I'm taking some advanced courses that assume background knowledge in things like phonology, which is something that I don't have. Anywho, I walked back the cat out of habit on this introduction and found out that Nathaniel Rich is a writer for the New York Times Magazine and wrote a book called King Zero about New Orleans. So it seems that he also has some agency to write about the South and, in turn, write about books about the South. One thing about his books that piqued my interest in general was because I'm super into movies, and he wrote a book about the film noir movement, and that was praised by Martin Scorsese himself. If you know anything about film, that's a pretty big deal. So I've linked his website in the description for y'all if you're interested on some of the research I did on him. I actually consider Didion, at least from the very few books that I've read from her thus far, to be a regionalist writer, almost similar to William Faulkner in that way. She writes in part about New York, Paris, and in this book, particularly the South, but in the end, she's a Californian and relies on California as the basis for her experiences in all of her books. As a bona fide linguistics major now, I notice that I am more apt to analyze and reanalyze the syntax that she uses in particular. Didina is such a great author to do this with because she exercises the amazing power of short sentences in her novels. So many authors, and myself included, though I'm not really published nowadays, are apt to show off their most complex writing, where the main idea of each sentence is buried in a pile of modifiers. It's different with Didion, though. Take, for example, the passage from South and West. Quote, "It occurred to me almost constantly in the South that had I lived there, I would have been an eccentric and full of anger, and I wondered what form the anger would have taken. Would I have taken up causes, or would I have simply knifed somebody?" What I love about her prose, effortlessly displayed in passages like this from South and West, and her essay books in particular, is that the progression of her ideas reaches a clarity unlike any other, especially in regards to the era that she's describing. In this case, she starts out by articulating a thought, something she wonders about quite often but never fully reconciles with, which is that she was once in a position to live in the South and is thinking about conditions in the South even though she's not a resident, then turns the sentence towards the case she's describing, Southerners, their quality of being perhaps eccentric and full of anger, and concludes back with herself and her thought about her position of understanding the South by becoming a part of it, which in the end never truly happens because, as I mentioned before, she's a regionalist writer and writes about the South with an articulation that can only come for someone who is in the outside looking in objectively but with a great reverence for the condition of the inside. I find her word order particularly interesting here too. "It occurred to me almost constantly," instead of the more expected, "it almost constantly occurred to me," where she deliberately decides to put the action of the sentence before the time frame, emphasizing her state of neuroticism when it comes to the issue of wondering about the South. "It occurred to me," a start to something that we would expect, in other words, to happen only once, to signify an important one-off occurrence, but instead she modifies it right afterwards with a piece, quote, "almost constantly," that challenges our immediate presupposition in favor of another scenario. Then she cultivates her simple, quote, occurrence by transforming it into, quote, wonder. We can even see this transformation mapped out by the way she takes the definitive, quote, "I would have," from the second half of the first sentence and flips it into a question, quote, "would I have," which in turn is even more definitive than the sentence before, except the observation is no longer about her, as the subject suggests. It's on the South still. Throughout the progression, we have the subject and tense changes, yet the main idea of the sentence stays with her perceptions of the South. The whole book is like this. It's crazy. I want to read another few passages in particular just because I think y'all will enjoy it, and I really thoroughly enjoyed reading this book as well. The first passage is indicative of her use of dialogue throughout the book. It's curt and sometimes in great quantities at once and super lovely. Quote, "This did not sound exactly right either, because I was not wearing my wedding ring." There was a long pause. "I went to school up north," he said. "I liked it a lot up there. I thought once I wouldn't mind living up there. But you came back here." "But," he said, "I came back here." The second, on the same page actually, page 60, is all her. Quote, "One evening in the Meridian, we went to the movies. Loving was playing with George Segal and Eva Marie Saint. The audience, what there was of it, gazed at the screen as if the movie were Czech. As it happened, I had seen Eva Marie Saint a few weeks before at dinner at someone's house in Malibu, and the distance between Malibu and this movie house in Meridian seemed limitless. How had I gotten from there to here? There, as always, was the question." Next is my favorite quote from the book, on page 104. "The time warp. The Civil War was yesterday, but 1960 is spoken of as if it were about 300 years ago." If we zoom out to look at the progression of the book as a whole, it follows her month-long excursion to the South, something that she seems to simultaneously loathe and savor as she's writing. More interesting is her conclusion on California as an overt realization of what is truly the centerpiece of a lot of her writing, as well as the book in general. I will add that the California notes section that the book ends with, in particular regarding her contemporary comments on the writing, is unexpectedly chilling, but I'll leave it there to avoid spoilers. Finally, this is certainly not the most overt choice for our hashtag Love of February series, and I know that. I don't need shade about that in the comments section, but there's a saying in linguistics that says to know the meaning of a sentence is to know its truth conditions, and similarly, I think that to know a place is to write about it as elegantly and indeed as knowingly as Didion has here. The more Didion I read, the more invested I realize she is in the systems, traditions, and most importantly, the people of particular places. And I would say that after finishing this book, that she does indeed love the places that she writes about. So I hope y'all are okay with some unconventional love this week. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, there's an episode of DH&I for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our back catalog of episodes, which should be available on whatever podcasting app you're listening on. If you need some guidance, try episode 22, just published in January, about dystopian fiction. I recorded it with Adam Wurst and really enjoyed that discussion. 2019 is the year of Didion, so if you'd like to follow along in my quest to read Joan Didion's collective works or learn more about the movement to bring lit back to people, everything can be found at didionandhawthorne.blueberry.net, and remember that blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Now you can also follow the show on Twitter with @DidionIn, 2 N's total. I'll be posting about new lit releases, reading lists, and of course new projects and episodes relating to DH&I. Also stay tuned for the next episode in a few days' time. We will be analyzing Norwegian Wood by Haruki Murakami. I'm pumped for this one, and I hope you all are too. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. Auf Wiederhören!